Hi, welcome back, MRA friends. I'm your host, Megan Bhatia, here with two fantastic special people who probably need no introduction. However, I will give you one. I am joined with Jessica Fern and David Cooley, and we'll be talking about their new book, Polywise, following up Jessica's first book, Polysecure. And Jessica, you and I had a chance to talk about that one earlier. You can go back to a previous episode. So thank you both for joining us today. I do want to give a formal introduction. So before we get into the conversations, if you don't know who these two are, you should. I will tell you a little bit about them. Jessica Fern is a psychotherapist, coach, and certified clinical trauma professional. She is the author of Polysecure, Attachment, Trauma, and Non-Monogamy. And there's an accompanying workbook. So that's very, very helpful. The book we'll be discussing today, that's Polywise, a deeper dive into navigating open relationships. And in her international practice, Jessica works with individuals, couples, and people in multi-partner relationships who no longer want to be limited by their reactive patterns, because who does, cultural conditioning, insecure attachment styles, and past traumas, helping them to embody new possibilities in life and love. You can follow her at jessicafern.com. And this is the first time I get to speak to you, David. So an introduction to the Amory audience is very appropriate. David Cooley is a professional restorative justice facilitator, which we will get into today, diversity and privilege awareness trainer, and bilingual cultural broker. Ooh, that sounds interesting. He's the creator of the Restorative Relationship Conversations Model, a process that transforms interpersonal conflict into deeper connection, intimacy, and repair. In his private practice, David specializes in working with non-monogamous and LGBTQ partnerships, incorporating a variety of modalities, including trauma-informed care, attachment theory, somatic practices, narrative theory, and mindfulness-based techniques. Oh my goodness, you two, welcome.
Thank you
for having us.
Well, it is such a pleasure. And I'm so excited for the conversation today. And I will do a little preparing of the setting the scene. You know, I'm trying to do my homework this morning. I've been listening to your book all probably for the last week or so, but I hadn't quite finished it. And I'm like getting my kids ready. They're out of school right now. And I am just lit up. I feel like I've been sitting with you two for the last like 3 hours or so. So now actually, I really am sitting with you and I have so many questions. But to get everybody started, I think it's so interesting to start to really go back to the origin of how and why this book was written and the your relationship that this was birthed out of. Can you give us a slight summary, if that's possible?
Yeah. So our relationship spans 21 years now. We met in Northern California. We're both originally East Coasters. We met at a remote massage school up in Northern California, residential. So, you know, like living in intentional community. And we had an initial romance of a few weeks and then really transitioned to friends and had a very special connection as friends for a few years. Then we were married for 10. We have a son together. We got divorced and we still live together. We were separated on divorce for a good year and a half. And now we live together in the same home, raising our son. We consider each other life partners. And we are co-authors as well. We're creative partners. So we've really navigated a lot of relationship fluidity through the decades. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you could. You literally have walked the walk and everything that you talk about in the book. There's absolutely no way that you could co-author this book, work together, raise a child together without actually practicing what it is that you preach. So it is really
what we talk about. Yeah.
And like, you know, what I've learned is we learn what we teach and we teach what we learn. So, you know, you might just be finding yourself continuing. And so I'm not quite sure where to start. I guess I'm going to start with what is most alive for me at this moment. And I will, I mean, if you haven't read the book, for sure, I feel like this is one of those handbooks of polyamory. I really appreciate that you get into parts work. That's extremely helpful. David, I love that you bring up the restorative justice part. And if you don't mind, I would love to dig into that because as I was reading it, I felt myself and what I've learned come alive in what you describe, down to the somatic work. I mean, I've stumbled into it and you've had a whole career of it. And I think it is so appropriate for people practicing polyamory. I mean, it's appropriate for humans, right? But almost impossible to relate in the structure without having a kind of a basic understanding of how to move through conflict. So could you give us a little background into your interest into conflict resolution and then step into some of the insights that you share in the book?
For sure. I think, you know, beginning with restorative justice, that's the origin for me, is working in the field of restorative justice, which comes under the umbrella of restorative practices. And I think the restorative concept is something that's been gaining a lot of momentum. It's not new necessarily, new-ish in terms of sort of just starting to really reach into the mainstream. More and more people are hearing that word and resonating with it, and it's been interesting to see how many clients find me because of that search through the concept of restorative work. And so that's where I got my start, was in a nonprofit in Colorado doing restorative justice, working with the courts, working with the cops, trying to give people who had committed a crime the opportunity to sit down with the people they had hurt in their community and figure out through conversation what is it that needs to be done to repair those ruptures that have happened, right? Or the, you know, just answer to take acknowledgement for the impacts of their behavior. So doing that for a while really just was powerful, and seeing the transformative process of restorative practices as something really useful, really practical, really applicable to conflict in a way that was different from other modalities was compelling for me. And after I got out of sort of doing it on the front lines on an institutional level, I realized that I needed to take a step back and figure out how to apply it in a way that was going to be more meaningful for me. And so realizing that there was sort of this niche to be filled on the interpersonal level, really got excited by that, started to research a little bit, and wasn't seeing anyone offering it in that format. And so I was recognizing, wow, there's this whole concept and way of doing restorative processes that no one, I think, has been touching at this point. You know, maybe there are a few now, but at that point, really just saw a wide open niche to fill.
Yeah. Can I say and add to that? When you talk about, so Jessica, in the beginning of the book, you focus more about the paradigm of open relating, or this new paradigm of relating. And David, when you bring in the paradigm of crime and punishment, I think it was the first time I really let that sink in. Like, wow, we are swimming in a paradigm of crime and punishment right now versus this. And when you say it, it makes so much sense, and I can't remember the exact words, so I'll hand it back over to you, but just this idea of we are relational creatures. When we can see a rupture or something like that, instead of shaming, blaming, shunning, disconnecting, and completely separating those individuals, having this repair process, it's like huge light bulb moment, like, duh, yeah, this is where we can head.
Yeah, and so much of this book is about how do we functionally change paradigms, the way that we think about approaching a process. And that's something, that's a level at which I really like to work, but it's not a level at which we're often discussing how to handle real on-the-ground problems. And so how do we sort of go back and forth and keep this overarching meta process in purview as we do something very localized? And so for me, it's really exciting to think about how do you change the way that your literal nervous system feels when you're about to step into a conflictual situation? Because that's part of what's problematic for people, is that we're afraid of conflict on a very, very deep and somatic level, right? And it's because of this paradigm of a punitive justice system that we've internalized, depending on the society that we've come up in. But if that paradigm has been set, and we're programmed to think that conflict is a necessary zero-sum game, and there's a loser and a winner, and the loser is a wrongdoer who deserves to have their character impugned with some kind of label, then we're going to go into it with a very tense disposition, and we're going to be primed to make things worse.
Yeah, and in an open relationship, that binary thinking of right and wrong and victim persecutor it doesn't serve us. In fact, we won't get very far, I don't think, in that paradigm. I keep going into, we're going from this binary world to a non-binary world, and it requires a whole different set of skills. So yeah, when you bring up there, could you walk people through maybe, I think it was 9 steps in the book, that would, you know, of how do you actually talk with people to get through these phases? Maybe, I've just lost an earbud. Maybe how did you two find learning this process or applying some of this into the relationship shifts that you had to go through? It doesn't have to be super personal, but I'm sure you not only like study this, practice this, but then also see the benefits of how you can communicate in that way.
Yeah, I think it's not something that we've formally used. Like, we haven't sat down and said, okay, we're going to do a restorative process together. I think there's been, because restorative work, or rather relational work, has been something that's been really important for us for so long, we've had our own way of doing it. I think there's things or ways that we relate that are restorative inherently, but it's not something that we've sat down and said, let's do a restorative conversation. That's something that's come after the fact. I think we had already internalized sort of our own pattern and have been refining that as time goes on. But really, it's about creating the space where you have a speaker and a listener. You assign roles, you decide who's going to talk first. And again, there's a lot of prep that goes into this, so I don't want this to be overly simplified. But for the sake of this conversation, we'll boil it down to the steps. And so it's really about creating a space where you get to hear each other in a new, possibly, way for the first time, right? It's someone's going to talk about what is the impact of a particular behavior or situation. The other person's going to really just hear that without reacting, without responding, without interrupting. And then after that person's had their chance to really communicate what feels important to share in the conflict or about the conflict, the listener reflects back without adding anything on top of it. And that's really the one of the most important parts of this is how do we, and it's very difficult for many of us to not want to add our
Very.
piece in, right? To start to explain, even to start to apologize. And it's not about that. It's about making sure you actually heard the other person say what they needed you to hear, have them have heard. And so that part is really indispensable. You can't skip that part. And it doesn't make sense to work on repair if you don't feel like you've actually been heard first. And so I think that's where some people sort of try to rush to an acknowledgement. Okay, yeah, let's get this done with. This is uncomfortable. Let's get out of this. And you can't. You need to make sure that you've been heard. Reflect that back and integrate that. And so both people get that chance to do that. Then you move into acknowledgement and you figure out what does acknowledgement mean to each of us in this particular context and what do each of us need to move forward. And so there's sort of steps that are built in to give each of you or whoever's, you know, the amount of people that's in a particular constellation of the conflict the chance to do that.
And for anyone listening where you're like, whoa, David, that was really fast, the whole thing is outlined in the book. So you
Totally.
just go back to the book. And I know that I've been with Marty for over 23 years. We are just getting to this process, like just going, oh yeah, one of us needs to speak first and we need to practice listening to the other one. I mean, now it's kind of comical to me, like, oh yeah, this is actually a really important way to communicate, to be heard, because we all desire to be heard in a relationship. The funny thing is, if both people want to be heard at the same time, nobody's listening. So that I always have to come back to. So I could ask you a lot more questions along this line, but I'm going to pause there and then come to another part where I really am lit up. And Jessica, this is part where it's your voice in the book, talking about the stages of relating and the stages of adult relationships. And you talk about it in the context of enmeshment. And I think I'm just starting to understand the gift that my parents gave me in the way that they related to me and not being enmeshed. You know, my parents let me travel to Belgium and leave the country for a year when I was 17. When I would tell my friends I was going to go do that, their first response was always, my parents would never let me go. And I always found that so sad. And now, reading the book, it just occurred to me that understanding of enmeshment, like the parent-child relationship, and then also what happens as we become adults and we develop these codependent relationships, which in the book you describe so beautifully as we are surrounded in this paradigm of relating, that that's actually the ultimate way to relate and romanticize this enmeshed, like codependent way of being, I guess. So I'm going to hand it over to you and speak on whatever point is popping out to you.
Well, I think you're bringing up a great point that often codependent tendencies and enmeshment are rooted in our childhood experiences, right? And there's no blame on that. Like so many parents, they don't realize they're doing it, but their purpose is their children. And yet that has a huge impact on children, you know, or they left one country and moved to another country so their children can have a better life. And these are positive things, but they can create these dynamics of where the child doesn't feel like it's okay to fully be myself, to be who I want to be. I have to sort of, you know, be in line with what my parents need, so to speak. So yeah, and one of the things that's really important to us is this distinction of not essentializing someone as being codependent or it being a personality diagnosis, you know, but that it's a pattern of behaviors that are learned. They can be very deeply ingrained in their that learning, right? But it's a pattern of behaviors that can also be unlearned. You know, and seeing it as this these behaviors that we're participating in, sometimes consciously, mostly usually unconsciously, that's interfering with us being in a healthy autonomy of self. Right? And we can mistake this codependency for closeness and connection with others. And so what we're teasing apart in that chapter is that actually true intimacy comes when we have two or more fully differentiated people who are allowed to bring all of themselves to the table and navigate the challenges of those differences and, you know, bring that fullness of each other.
Yeah, and the word I think you used to describe that final stage of relating was interdependence. Was that right?
So right, you're talking about the stages, which is Ellen Bader's model of couples' developmental stages that mimics and parallels childhood development with the caretaker, with their parent. And so for the audience, you know, first there's symbiosis, which is the sweet falling in love, the couple bubble, the romantic stage of a relationship, new relationship energy. And it's the honeymoon phase, you know. And it's funny because we say that, we say the honeymoon phase, but we don't think it's a phase you actually are supposed to leave, right? We kind of want to stay in this symbiotic phase because it feels so good. But we're not meant to stay in that, just like a child is not meant to stay forever in the arms of their caretakers. They're meant to then, you know, start crawling and moving and actually going away and coming back, right? Differentiating. So after symbiosis, partners then differentiate. And this is a hard phase. Even for healthy, happy couples, their differentiation stage will be more, there'll be higher conflict. Because now it's like, oh, we're not the same. We don't agree on everything. We don't want everything the same. We actually have differences, and we have to figure out how to navigate these differences. Right? And so then what happens is most partners, the conflict increases. And it either breaks them up, it's too much, right? And that might be legit, right? You're not meant to stay together. There are too many differences, right? Or we didn't know how to deal with figuring out the conflict of differentiation and we caused too much damage in the conflict, right? So the relationship ends. Or it's too much, so we try to go back to symbiosis. And that is not actually staying in symbiosis. It would be a regression into codependency, where only parts of me are allowed. And if I don't talk about this, you won't talk about that. And only parts of you are allowed, but not all of us, right? Or obviously, the option is to go through. And if we really hang in there and do the work of healthy differentiation and not being codependent, but interdependent, we move into these other stages, which is like healthy individuation, and then this reconnecting phase, and then this mutual interdependence, which is pretty incredible.
It is. And what I find for me, I actually, listening to that part of the book, I was seeing my relationships evolve. Kind of like, I know when I was in that phase. So I was in that kind of codependent phase with Marty for years. Only part of me was allowed in that relationship. There's a lot of resent. Opening up the relationship obviously brought us into that individuation, and it was painful and scary. And I think that it's kind of like a pendulum. I pulled really far back, really into myself, kind of denying meeting of any of his needs, not really listening to it because I was like, I don't even, that was kind of what I needed to actually find me again. And then the coming back together as our new selves, like we've done that, I think, several times now. And getting to this point where I feel comfortable to say we are at that phase of I feel interdependent with him. The way that we raise kids together, I've just over the last 2 weeks, a lot is on my mind right now because Marty is in Greece with his other partner. Kyle has started a new relationship, so he's living in Oregon, like literally living together with a new partner. And I'm here with my kids. I kind of have a new connection, and he was on vacation for 3 weeks. So I feel like I had this little bubble of really checking back in with myself. And within the context of the stages that you describe in the book, I feel like this time has given me a really big opportunity to check back in and say, where am I? Where am I in this stage of relationship? And with Kyle, I feel like I didn't know it, but we really got beautifully stuck in that symbiosis phase. And because we weren't always living together, it kind of extended out that honeymoon. And because he's now with a new partner, I'm actually very much feeling that differentiation. And we're working through that relationship shift. We're really trying to figure out, well, who are you? Who am I? What do you want? What do I want? How do we stay together? How do we keep our hearts open to each other? And so it gives me a lot of, I guess, strength in reading and understanding the model a little bit more of these different stages to say, okay, now we're in that differentiation stage, and we're coming back together in a couple of weeks. We'll be spending some good quality time together in Arizona soon, and I feel like we'll get a chance to kind of come back together, but in different ways. And I think for the people out there, my heart kind of breaks, I guess, for the large part of our community who doesn't necessarily have this mental model to say, where are you in this and what are the possible challenges, pitfalls? Because I see a lot of people that do definitely break up in that differentiation phase, or are really quick to give up on each other to say, like, well, this other one's way better. I'm going to go over here. I know you both coach and, you work with people. Where do you see people falter and I guess what additional skills or mental frameworks or support might people need at the different stages, if they want to stay connected and have a healthy, loving relationship?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest supports is sort of integrated into the intention of the book, which is to create more of a holistic or global description of the process as something normal, right? So we're trying to normalize the process of something like differentiation. So all the stages really, but really we spend a lot of time on the differentiation phase because in our work with clients, this is where we're seeing people really get stuck. And so part of what's necessary to help people normalize this is to recognize the ways in which the culture, at least for those of us living in particular cultures and sort of the Western Hemisphere of the world, the normalization of the symbiosis phase is sort of like the elements of the symbiosis phase have been sort of held up by a monogamous culture, predominantly monogamous culture, as this is the ideal. And if your relationship is missing these elements or you've lost this, which is inevitable, then something's wrong with you, the relationship, the partner, partners, right? And so there's sort of this default into pathologization of some element of your experience relationally. So that's where we really want to sort of normalize it. No, this is where we're supposed to get into this differentiation. And what are the ways that the culture you're embedded in have made that seem like a problem ad hoc? And so having that at the baseline of your exploration, I think, is really important.
My gosh, that's nothing short of culturally revolutionary, David. Like, I mean, it really just looking at the water that we swim in, all the movies, all the rom-coms. I was with my new, I don't know what to call him yet, the new person in my life and his wife, and we were hanging out and we were just joking about all of the music that we listen to, and now it just sounds toxic. It's like, that's really not healthy. Those lyrics are
That's really
really scary, and
codependent.
that's super cool. Like, that's bordering on some dysfunctionality there, and that's the water that we swim in. I'm even
Absolutely.
with my kids growing up, they're watching movies,
Exactly.
and they're watching these movies, and they're young characters, and it's like always a love interest and how they're relating. And so I'm trying to raise my kids. They obviously know both of their parents love other people. We talk about that. We talk about how marriage, you can only in the law marry one person at a time, but you can love more than one person. Just yesterday I was saying, I have a crush on this person. My daughter's like, oh yeah, you can have crushes on more than one person. So it was like really, really cute. But I mean, it really is the water that we're swimming in. So I want to give you guys credit for writing this book, for working on, I think, the revolution that is happening in the field of relating. Yeah, I digress. I don't know. It's kind of like the bigger frame I have for where we are in time. You know, maybe in 100 years, people will look back and go, whoa, they were kind of in the relationary dark ages. They didn't really understand much about relating. That might be a fun question outside of what the book covers, but how do you two see the future of relating going? What might people look back on our times in 100 years and say, you know, in your world, where would you want it to go? And how would you want people to have? What skills do they have? How are they relating? Yeah, how might they talk about our time now?
They would. Well, our specific time is opening up and expanding. And I don't even just mean with monogamy, but, you know, same-sex partnerships and marriages and different sexual orientations and gender orientations and expressions and identities. So I think we're currently in this moment that, like you said earlier, we're moving into a non-binary time, which is incredible and complicated, right? So we might look back on this time and be like, wow, it was real, you know, the time that the three of us sort of were born into initially of, wow, it was really limited, right? To only have two genders to choose from initially, right? Or to only have one person that you can marry at a time. Even when we, you know, I think all three of us are around the same age, right? That sexual orientation was also two options, right? Straight or gay, that was it. So just to see what our children are being born into already with this whole spectrum is really incredible. So, yeah, I think, and I'll be curious, you know, what that legally means, how it changes the law, you know, if it does legal marriage, will it exist in the future or not? And I'm not anti-existing, but I just don't know where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, looks like your sound dropped off, Megan.
Yeah, sorry about that. I didn't catch that last part, Jessica. The concept of marriage, is that what you were talking about? Does that drop off?
I'm just saying we have no clue, right? I'm not anti-marriage, but you know, how will that concept continue to evolve? That is it with multiple people, and is it a lifetime commitment? Is it legal? Does that matter anymore? All these ways that we conceive of marriage. Yeah, I'm very curious. Yeah. And I love what people are doing now, the way they're having commitment ceremonies or spiritual marriages or partnership marriage. You know, there's different ways. So I think it's going to be more a choose your own adventure kind of storybook.
Yeah, I can see that. I hope for that. Yeah, because like you said, there's one template. And if this is the template, I always think if there's only one choice, you don't have a choice. That's there's no choice involved in that when there's one option. How about you, David? What do you see?
Yeah, I think it makes me reflect on kind of how TV was when I was a kid. You know, you had three channels, essentially, maybe four, right? There was like NBC, ABC, and whatever. You know, it was like, and then you had like someone down the block, the rich kid on the block had cable, you know, you're like, what? And you would go to their house and be like, wow, this whole universe of possibilities there you didn't even imagine before. And so in that way, I think it's a lot like that. Now we're sort of saturated with infinite content possibilities. And so how do you find meaning in just kind of an infinite just array of choices? I think that's going to be more of the question for me, is like, how do you as an individual locate your personal metric for what's meaningful and significant when you have so many choices possible? For me, it's sort of the other end of the spectrum in terms of the question. It's not necessarily what will be the choices, but like, how do we deal with infinite choices that I'm really curious about? You know, and so part of that
follow-up question. Oh yeah. Oh, go ahead.
And, you know, and thinking about what Jessica was saying about marriage, it's like, what will be relevant to our lived experience past a certain point? It's not even like what's legal or desirable. It's like, what's relevant actually, in a similar way that language changes, right? You think about the evolution of Latin. Latin started as a peasant language, grew to one of the most widely used languages in the world, and now it's a academic curiosity at best, right? Who really speaks Latin? So it's interesting to see the trajectory of these things, right? And so will monogamy be one of those things that was just like, wow, that was the gold standard for relationships for a really long time. And then it was just sort of this oddity that people look back on and be like, wow, that was weird that we did that for so long. I don't know. I'm not saying that it should be that way, but it's interesting to see these trajectories of things and how that are so influential for a long time and then become irrelevant.
Oh, I can definitely see that. And I guess a follow-up question to you would be, if we have so much choice, what is the skill set that the next generation will need to find themselves, to create meaning? I find myself thinking about that a lot as a parent, and you two are obviously parent of a, I think, a child about the same age. My twins are 8.
Yeah.
Your son is
eight.
Nine?
He's
8?
He's 8.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that question. And I think for me, that's where, and this is the great equalizer, I think, across my work is attachment theory and polyvagal theory. Like, those are two of the most helpful concepts in the work that I do, at least, because they're so universal and cut across so many of the differences that we create as human beings, right? And so cultural, linguistical, racial, like all these things that seem to divide us, we're really unified in our somatic experience as human beings with our nervous systems. And so for me, it's recognizing that this is something that we share that's universal. What is a relationship feel good? How does it feel good on an attachment level? What are attachment needs? And what does it mean to know that in your body in a felt sense in real time?
And that's our first language. I remember when I got that sentence first of like, oh yeah, the English is my second language. My body is my first language. And it's all of our first languages. And yeah, I keep thinking that that has to be part of our formal education going forward. If we keep a structured educational system, don't you think that that would be helpful information to say, you are a mammal, you have a nervous system. This is kind of the user manual for having a nervous system. And to be accountable for our nervous system. David, you get into in the book really talking about managing and understanding your triggered state. If you want to talk to people a little bit more about that, understanding, and you ask some really good questions in there, like how do you know you're triggered from the inside, from the outside? I mean, I love the somatic work. So anything you want to share on that note?
Yeah, I mean, I love that too. And I think, again, it's such a grounding principle. Unfortunately, so many of us have been taught to disconnect from our somatic experience. And so how easy is it for you to name an emotion, right? Many clients have a hard time when I say, what are you feeling right now? Name, they go into thought, they go into cognition. And it's so interesting how much work it takes to get them to just locate a feeling. And so much of what we've done in the West, at least, is sort of disembody emotions. So we even talk about emotions as if they were separate from the somatic experience. And so part of the work is even reconnecting emotional experience to the somatic experience. And so it's interesting to see, okay, where do people first locate their own sensation or own experience of conflict, i.e. their nervous system's activation in the face of a trigger? Can they recognize a physical sensation? Can they connect to an emotion? Or is it just the cognition first? And so that's sort of the trifecta, is like somewhere along that spectrum of possibilities, where can you connect? Ideally all three, and then you have a much better map of your experience. But often the emotional and somatic piece are the hardest for people to connect to.
Yeah, I kind of view it like a circle, and you can enter in at any point in the circle. You know, you can enter in through thought, you can enter in through your body, you can enter in through the feelings. The work that I do at my kids' school is really getting kids into their bodies.
Cool.
And it's so funny that even at 6 or 7, I'll ask them, okay, I'll ask them, how are you feeling? I'm like, good. I'm like, where is good in your body? Where does that live in your body? Or, I'm feeling sad. Where does that live in your body? And describe it with words. And then we get into even how sometimes sensations can have, you know, a feeling might have multiple physical sensations. The other day, actually, this is kind of a funny story. I was in the kitchen and I'm like, God, I feel like I'm having a panic attack. My chest was so tight. And that's what I associate to, is like, oh my God, I'm super anxious. What is happening? And my good friend was like, Megan, we just went rock climbing yesterday. And then we worked out a lot yesterday. Are you perhaps sore? And I like started poking around the muscles in here. I'm like, oh my God, I am. That's my muscles that are literally constricting my chest. Like, thank God I'm not having a panic attack. I'm just really sore from working out these particular muscles that are now like all tightened around my heart. So it's so funny, is even as adults and even someone, I mean, I feel like I'm in this work a lot, that it's so hard to tease out Like, what am I feeling? What is this? Where might this be coming from? Again, back to the curriculum of being human, I feel like we got to plug this one in there too. And see that the work, I feel like the work that you two are doing in identifying some of these relational patterns, the somatic work, it really doesn't matter the structure of the relationship that you're in. I mean, obviously it is much more help, like it is almost a non-negotiable to have to learn if you're going to practice polyamory. I feel like this is the playbook, the skill set book. But I do think it should be part of the human curriculum of this is just what we go through being human and how we relate.
We're already getting that kind of feedback.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like, oh, this is really, even though it's, you know, for a polyamorous audience, people saying, oh, there's so much in this book that's really just for any relationship, even non-romantic relationships, right? Just human relating. Yeah.
Completely, completely. And I know you do primarily work in the realm of polyamory, right? Do you see this opening up more, though? Have you been invited to speak at different places that aren't necessarily niche to the open relating or polyamorous community? Is there a tendency of taking this skill set and applying it to the greater whole?
Yeah. I'm getting requests for people to, you know, from people to speak in more mainstream places or... Yeah, which is great.
Yay! Like, keep going, guys, keep going. You're like the front of the boat that breaks the ice. You're like, bring some of this into mainstream. Okay, admittedly, I did not get into the last part of the book, and you said I would really, really like it. So can you give me a little teaser on that last bit and some of the pieces? I know, I'm like the bad student that didn't finish the homework. But that last chapter and kind of the aim of the book and how you want to support people in the relationships.
Yeah, so in the last chapter, it's about the awakening of the self. And so many people that I was working with would describe their transition from monogamy to polyamory, especially people who identify it as their orientation. But not only those people, but they really would describe it as this awakening of the self. Right? That, you know, this liberation of themselves, this liberation of their sexuality, right? Liberation of their needs. And, you know, there's so many, you know, the chrysalis, the caterpillar that goes through the chrysalis and becomes a butterfly. And they would keep using these transformation metaphors, right? Or these metaphors, like the toothpaste that can't be put back into, you know, the tube, right? So these sort of complete transformations where you can't necessarily go back, right? And so that was obviously very interesting and curious to me, to really embrace that this is an experience people are having. And it can be from any paradigm shift, you can have this kind of experience. And so I think the chapter really does two things that are important. Is one, we talk about, so separate from what we all were just talking about a few minutes ago, of the couple's developmental model of how couples move through developmental stages, we talk about one of the theories of adult developmental shifts, right? That children don't just develop, right? That through stages, that adults actually continue to go through stages of development. And we use Robert Keegan's model because it's a relatively simplified model of five stages, whereas a lot of models have 7 or 11 or 12 stages.
Like Ken Wilber's, it's Ken, like right? Very extensive.
Spiral dynamics, which I love all of those. But yeah, we went with this one. And so we have, you know, there's sort of the adolescent imperial mind is one of the stages. And most adults are either in that stage or the next stage, which is the socialized mind, which is really about doing what everyone else says, right? Doing what the authority says or what my boss tells me to do, or I do it because my parents told me to do it or the doctor said to do it, right? Or my teacher, right? So we're externally, you know, our authority is coming, becoming external. Our compass is external. Right. And that's not necessarily like a bad thing, right? Because in this stage of the socialized mind, there's also a lot of care for those around us, right? And a sense of belonging and wanting to be in community, right? But there's still this idea of like right and wrong, play by the rules. If you step out of the norm or you step out of the box, you're not okay and you're shunned and you're exiled, right? So after that, the next stage of development is the self-authoring mind, right? And this is where a lot of people experience this kind of awakening, where it's not what I'm supposed to be, because society or my family or my culture says, it's who do I want to be, or who do I feel myself to truly be from the inside. So it's this awakening of more of the authentic self. So I think based on what you were saying before, it's what are the capacities we're going to need in this world where there's so many choices, right? Where I can author myself, right? Right? With so many different options. And that really is going to be this internal self-attachment and the ability to attune internally to know, you know, what is my truth? What is my authentic expression? Mm-hmm. And how that even evolves. It's not a static thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's one piece in the chapter. And we talk about what non-monogamy looks like in all these different stages, for better or worse. but then another part of the chapter is Dave's story on sometimes this paradigm shift isn't actually this beautiful awakening of the self. It's a quite scary deconstruction of the self. And it's really difficult. And it sort of parallels that dark night of the soul. You know, crisis situation. So we get into that as well.
David, you want to speak to that part?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gritty and can be really terrifying and feel like the doors are coming off existentially your reality. And many people, it's really connected to going through some form of primal panic brought on by just intense attachment ruptures. And so when we're not prepared for that and we don't understand how severe that can be, because I think we're really good at underestimating how big those processes can be for some, it can really create a process that's very challenging to overcome, make it through, and integrate. And so I wanted to be really bare bones honest as possible about what it was like for me and not pretend that it was something else, even though there were some of those other parts in my experience along. It wasn't just this monolithic experience that it was all bad or all dark. There was it was punctuated by a lot of the beauty that we're talking about in this transformative phase, but it was also one of the hardest things I've literally ever gone through. Right. And I've lived with a chronic autoimmune condition for over 25 years. I know some things about certain kinds of pain and challenges, but this was just like, holy shit. It just set the bar for another new possibility. Yeah. So making it through that, integrating that, and then helping other people really understand what that is as it's happening or after it's happened felt really important.
Wow, hugely important. And thank you for sharing your story in that. I feel like more of us need to admit, like, hey, this shit's not easy. And it's hard every time you do that. I mean, it's very vulnerable. And I think that that's a beautiful way to lead and to share and let people know, like, they're not alone. And this is, I mean, yeah, I don't know anything. I haven't come across anything that is as earth and ego shattering as this process. I really don't. You know, I would say, you know, I like doing ice baths now, and that's cold exposure therapy. This is emotional exposure therapy. I mean, at the biggest level, I don't know anything that can bring a human being through quite the same process in such a short amount of time. That's why I truly believe that this is a spiritual path. I think anyone that steps down the path of open relating, either I would invite them to be open to say, like, what is your, how do you ground yourself in meaning? To me, that's like spirituality, is like, how do you create meaning for yourself? Because if you do not have that grounded, what you're about to embark on is going to fuck up your world. And you're going to need some orientation in there, because you will be and feel very disoriented. Because it will challenge everything that you know about the world, all the paradigms that we live in, and even how you view yourself. If you do not have that idea of your shit's going to get so fucked up, and it's going to be incredible, but this is a spiritual path. Do not, you know, like, tread lightly. Like, this is transformational, you know, to say the very least. I think people that have gone through this in a really successful way, and I mean success as in looking at you too. You know, you may not have the marriage intact that you do, and you have a relationship. You are not sitting there blaming each other for, you just wrote a book together on all of this. You're not blaming each other for what you have experienced through the relationship that you've had. You really have alchemized your experience. And I would say that that is a very successful experience of the open relating, because I think where people want so much security is like, tell me how it's going to go.
Right.
Tell me, are we going to stay together? Tell me, are we going to, what's the certainty out of this? And I'm like, hey guys, I love you. I know your brain wants certainty. This is not going to be there. Not in a way that you have been trained to want to understand yourself in the world. And I think it's our relationship to that uncertainty that is fundamental. Like, that's where we're changing. Is how, to me, it's all about relating. It's like, how are you relating to yourself? How are you relating to certainty? How are you relating to, you name it? And I really do think that this is a revolution in the way that we relate, like, all across the board. So that was a long way of saying, like, thank you. I'm glad that you open up and get into, yeah, that this is not easy. Could you share a little bit of your personal insights, David, on, like, where have you come to know yourself? How have you come to know yourself? If this is the catalytic experience of a caterpillar to a butterfly. How has that been for you personally? How do you relate yourself now versus before?
Yeah, I think what it's given me is a really solid grasp of what my attachment needs are, and sort of what my, at least for now, at this phase in my life, what the kind of parameters of my emotional bandwidth are, right? Like what I can tolerate, what I can handle. And being really comfortable with that. I think before there was a way in which I thought there was a lot of ideas, you know, kind of based on some older ego constructs that I relate to some of those stages that I've passed through or have experienced in my journey, that really framed an identity of, oh, I should be able to handle this. I should be able to do this. I should be able to integrate that experience, or I should be able, you know, all these shoulds underlying these constructs about who I thought I was supposed to be or thought I wanted to be. And so where I've really landed is in, I think, a very stark embodied sense of what my nervous system can handle and being really comfortable with that, right? Before it was just like, yeah, anything goes. And now it's like, no, that doesn't work for me. And I know why, and I know what it feels like for it not to work. And so, yeah, I think I have a sense of where I'm willing and ready to lean into growth edges, and the pace more than anything is like, what's my pacing if I am going to lean into a growth edge with a partner around sort of a, you know, an experience like, okay, we're opening to do this thing. Okay. And then how do we reclose that container, integrate that? Like, the integration process and pacing for me are fundamental. So I just feel like I have a much better sense of my needs more than anything. And it's a very lived experience. It's not theoretical. It's not intellectual. It's nope, this works. I'm willing to play with that, but only within certain parameters. And that's been probably the biggest boon for my well-being.
I love that. And what I hear is that phrase, know thyself. Mm-hmm. Know thyself. And I'm going to add, be accountable for thy nervous system. Is the other piece, you know, that is being fully accountable for your nervous system. You become safe, right? So what I hear is that you have become accountable for how to create safety for yourself, which then creates safety for others. And I think we're all walking around with these nervous systems and not knowing how to manage them, and we don't know what they need. And when we are unsafe, when we are literally triggered, we become unsafe for everyone else around us. So what I'm getting out of what you just shared is, like, now you have stopped intellectualizing it, and you just know, this is what I need to be the person I want to be in the world. And this is what this nervous system needs. And I might have these ideals over here, but really, like, really, this is what I need. And I can relate as well. I have this idea of, like, I can feel compersion no matter what. And Kyle, living with his new partner, I'm like, my nervous system is like, no, that's a no-go. Do not. I have a healthy boundary now, right now, in the moment, of saying I do not wish to have that information right now. I can deal with it. I intellectually understand they're living together, but I need my body to catch up. Because what I realized is, when I got some information, I was compromised. I wasn't safe. My nervous system wasn't, like, I was triggered. So then I became unsafe for him and unsafe for us. So I'm realizing right now, even though part of me wants to be like, I can handle it all. Sure, I can feel compersion. I'm like, okay, this body, not right now. I want to. But right now, to be safe, I'm going to limit information. And I feel like that's a new revelation for me in understanding how to actually use boundaries to create a safer nervous system for me and show up as the person I want to in my relationships. And I'm gonna leave room that could change. Like in a little bit, I could have more space to hear more. And I'm open to that right now, but I hear myself in you to say I'm really being accountable for my nervous system right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And how about for you, Jessica? How has your journey been through practicing polyamory, your transformation?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to sum up because it feels so long and ongoing. I mean, but overall, I wouldn't trade it. Yeah. I echo a lot of what David said around just, I think it's really brought me to know myself better, to know my needs differently. I think a lot around my sexuality that before polyamory, I wouldn't have said was even shut down or bad, but like so much around my own sexuality has completely awakened into what feels like my more genuine expression of me. Yeah.
Beautiful.
And just a larger awareness of life saturation. I can't have as many partners as my heart maybe has the capacity to have or the desire to have. There's just a, you know, realistic assessment of like, what is my, I talk about living on credit, you know, like we can get in trouble if we live off of credit in terms of our credit cards, right? So being really aware of living off energetic or relational credit and how much can you actually do that? And what do relationships actually need? I think actually that's probably one of the biggest takeaways. Like what do relationships actually need? And what do I specifically need in relationships to feel healthy and secure? Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Not be in a disorganized wobble.
Yes. Oh my God. And that life saturation. What does it feel like, by the way, to run on energetic credit? Because I think I understand the concept, but what would that look and feel like?
You can't fulfill, you're like, you can't follow through. There's too much. I don't have time for myself. No one's really happy. No one's really getting enough time. Mm. Like this sort of, yeah, right. It's high interest.
Yeah, being real. Yeah. Like managing ourselves in 3D world and space and time. Yes. Mm-hmm. So what I hear, I mean, it's really beautiful summary of managing our nervous system, being accountable for our nervous system, knowing our needs and needs in relationship, knowing our personal needs in relationship, and managing this 3D body in space and time. It like sounds like pretty beautiful and fundamental ways of being a human in the world. So thank you both. This has been so fascinating. I hope that everyone gets intrigued by this. And if you have not read the book Polywise, please go out there. Make sure you check out PolySecure as well. I love that you have a workbook. That's extremely helpful. And Jessica, where do people find you?
Yeah, they can find me on my website at jessicafern.com.
Fantastic. Thank you, too. I hope to meet you in person one day here.
Yeah, thank you, Megan. Good to meet you.
Thank you, Megan.
My pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.